We invite you to join TGC International Outreach in the cause of theological famine relief, helping to equip pastors around the world through books and digital resources. You can partner with us by giving or by carrying books with you when you travel overseas. More information at tgc.io. This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen. Everywhere, militants were blowing up Christians, their churches, their shops. They threatened them with kidnapping. They promised to take their children. The message to these infidels: you have no place in Iraq. Pay a penalty to stay, leave, or be killed. This description is from a new book called They Say We Are Infidels, On the Run from ISIS with Persecuted Christians in the Middle East. The scene depicted is Iraq in 2006, 8 years before ISIS started targeting Iraqi Christians for persecution. The current onslaught from ISIS is only the latest in a string of threats to Christianity in Iraq and Syria. Here to talk with me about Christians in the Middle East is Mindy Bells, senior editor of World Magazine and the author of They Say We Are Infidels. Thank you, Mindy, for joining me today.
Thank you, Colin.
Let's just start from the very basics, Mindy. We've had Iraq in the news for a long time in the United States.
Right.
But what is the origin of Christianity in Iraq?
Well, you think about the two rivers that flow out of the mountains of Turkey down into what used to be ancient Mesopotamia, the Tigris and the Euphrates, as the rivers that we read about even in Genesis 1. And so you could argue that Genesis is where Iraq begins. But then we, you know, from there you have Abraham coming out of Ur, which is south of present-day Baghdad, moving north into an area that is where we see a lot of the conflict now. I mean, you settled for a while in an area that's not far from Aleppo in Syria. He moved on into what we think of as the Promised Land, into what's now modern-day Israel. But if you think about our early stories from the Old Testament, his descendants kept going back to that area, and it was never far from their consciousness, I would say. They went back there for wives. They went back there to reconnect with their families. And so all the way through the Old Testament, and then, you know, coming right along to the Babylonian captivity, where most of the Jewish population was actually exiled into what is modern day Iraq. And there they flourished over time. They set up academies. They were very involved in sciences and learning. And so there was this flourishing literate community that was established there by the time of Christ. And so when some of the disciples, there are a lot of different stories, but were sent out from Jerusalem following the death of Jesus Christ, a number of them came down through what is now Syria and Iraq. And we have monasteries. I've been to a monastery there that I've been to several, actually, believed to be some of the oldest Christian monasteries in the world. They came along in the 200s and 300s. And for me, this was all a revelation. The first couple of trips that I made to Iraq, I was there because I was just another journalist covering the war. And then suddenly I'm confronted with Christian communities that can trace their lineage back to the 300s and 400s. And I thought, these people have something that I, an American Christian, don't have. And there's a rich history there that's there to be explored.
Let's jump way ahead from there and let's talk about, get closer to what is more familiar probably to a lot of the listeners, especially in the United States. But how would you describe how Christians fared under Saddam Hussein's mm-hmm. rule in Iraq?
Well, there was a thriving Christian population. The last time a census was done in Iraq, which was in the later years of the Saddam Hussein regime, there were about 1.3 million Christians in Iraq. We know today that there are probably less than 250,000 left. Oh, wow. That is just this dramatic, amazing decline that's happened over the course of the U.S. invasion there. But under the Saddam Hussein regime, you know, people will say Saddam Hussein was an equal opportunity persecutor, and he persecuted the Shiites, he persecuted the Kurds, and he persecuted the Christians, and he did. He was hard on everybody. But I think that, you know, there was this, as the war became worse, the U.S., after the U.S. invasion, people would often say, oh, things were better under Saddam Hussein. But if you really sat down and talked with an Iraqi, and especially Iraqi Christian, they would deny that. And in particular, I don't think I spoke to an Iraqi Christian man who was not in some way, he was either jailed or lost his business or somehow forced out of his livelihood in the Saddam Hussein years. I interviewed men, especially men who were involved in starting churches. If you were part of that kind of movement, an evangelical movement that was starting churches, if you were caught, you were jailed. And I talked to a group of men who were all kept together in a 6x6 cell for weeks and months. And the conditions they described, which you can imagine, were just horrible. And they weren't released until some U.S. forces came in and freed them shortly after the war began. And that was because they had started house churches, and they were doing something that, you know, is a common activity here. So established churches did okay under, but Saddam was known to be known to be explosive after following the Gulf invasion, the U.S. and British invasion of 1991. And the start of the Gulf War, he shut down the Anglican Church in Baghdad, just closed it. It had been there since, you know, for 100 years. So that was how it was.
Well, that's very helpful. Well, tell us how you got started with on-the-ground reporting in the Middle East, and talk about your first trip to Iraq after the U.S.-led invasion.
Well, I actually, I had been to the Middle East on various other reporting covering the Intifada and Israel, that sort of thing. But I went to Israel and then to Syria shortly after 9/11 with a group of Christians who were going to do dialogue with Muslims in the Middle East following 9/11. Among that group were several people who had family members who had been killed in the Twin Towers. And so it was, you know, this intense emotional time of everyone wanting to come together and find out ways to avoid that sort of thing ever happening again. At the end of that trip, I made a trip to Iraq. There were already, you know, not just rumors, but the Bush administration was essentially saying they were going to go to war and they wanted to topple Saddam Hussein. So I felt like it was important to go to Iraq before that happened so that we would have a barometer of what would happen, you know, of what was to come. And you had the sense that the Middle East was on the verge of going through the tumultuous changes that we now see continuing and even getting worse. But so that was my first trip to Iraq. That was in 2002. And then I went back toward the end of 2003. We had a reporter who went right after the invasion. But then I went back as a reporter for World Magazine, the end of 2003. What I did, though, is I flew in with, and this was just kind of the way, you know, connections are made sort of in a seemingly random way. I flew into Baghdad with a Christian Iraqi who had been forced out of the country in the mid-1990s and was going back for the first time. Keep in mind, no Skype, none of the social media we're used to now. So this was the first time that she was actually seeing in any kind of real way her family members, including her sister and a grandmother she was very close to in nearly a decade. And I wanted to go with her simply to see what it would be like, what it was like for these Iraqis to see the war through their eyes. And as I've said, what I didn't anticipate was that was going to introduce me to this very vibrant Christian community that was both old, that dated back to the earliest time of Christianity and was also very evangelical and was committed to continuing to see Christianity flourish in the Middle East. Insaf Safu, the woman who I went back with and who becomes a very big part of the book and very big part of my life, grew up in a Chaldean church, one of the oldest churches in the Middle East, but became an evangelical in her late teens and early 20s. And, you know, is someone that we sort of modern evangelicals could identify with very readily.
What's going on with her today? I mean, for those who I hope will go and pick up this incredible book that I've had the privilege of reading, her example is amazing. I mean, inspiring, compelling, you run out of adjectives. And her, you know, you're going back and her going back really forms the narrative backbone of this book from start to finish. Do you keep up with her still now? Regularly? I mean, okay, so Kenny, I'm almost just interested to ask this as a reader who is so captivated by her story, but what's the very latest from her?
Well, the very latest is that she will be headed back to Iraq again in about 10 days' time. Wow. And she'll be doing what she's been doing. She'll be organizing. Right now, our focus is organizing events for women, focusing on the women who have been whose families have been chased out by ISIS, who are living in refugee camps, who are living in church basements, in high-rise apartment buildings that were never finished, where, you know, they have plastic sheeting for walls and things like that. Her focus is bringing those women together, letting them share their grief together, letting them heal together, letting them, you know, similar to what we would do in any kind of ministry we'd want to do in the United States where we're dealing with traumatized people. You want to bring them together and let them see how they can help one another and how they can share their grief together. And that's really her focus now. What's striking about Insaf is that, you know, she went back to Iraq in 2003 in those heady early days of the war when we all thought, you know, Saddam Hussein was gone. A new day was coming. The United States was going to bring good things to Iraq. Everyone thought that, including the Iraqis. She went back thinking that this was like a scouting trip, that she and her husband and her children were going to be able to move back to Iraq, that they were going to sort of get their old lives back. They had been refugees for nearly a decade, and that they would get their old lives back. Well, that quickly became impossible for them. And so she lives in Canada and makes these trips back and is doing everything she can. This is sort of her life's work, is to help the people who have stayed there.
You led right into my next question, which it's kind of amazing to me in all the recrimination about the Iraq war on the American side, but it's still caught up so much in partisanship. I don't think we've fully come to grips with how the tragedy unfolded over the course of two different American presidential administrations, one that's about to come, the second of which is about to come to an end, but both of which bear a great deal of responsibility and represent both major political parties in this country. Mm-hmm. It was so striking that you did find so much of that hope after Hussein's fall, and that corresponds to the kind of things that we were hearing from our political leaders at the time. And I'm interested to know, just I think the simplest way to put it is, what went wrong? I mean, was it wrong? I mean, was it doomed from the very beginning, or was there something according to what you saw on the ground, according to those Christians who have lived through this, and cannot simply just push it out of their lives the way so many Americans have seemed to have done, but from their perspective, was it doomed from the beginning, or where did it go wrong?
I don't think it had to be doomed from the beginning. I think that definitely where we are as a culture in America has a lot to say about how we are able to project ourselves overseas and especially to prosecute a war. And I think the thing that you can't get away from is this was a U.S.-led war. We decided to go into it everyone in Congress voted for it except one, and the American people supported it. And so what's happened then is this kind of, in light of that, what to me is somewhat of an immature partisanship that you allude to, where we've tried to make other people responsible for it. The Democrats tried to make the Republicans responsible. Republicans tried to make the Democrats responsible. The bureaucrats of the State Department tried to make the military responsible. The military tried to make the State Department responsible for all the things that went wrong. And now you have, you know, everybody, it's just this endless cycle of making other people responsible for what is an American responsibility to, I believe, the people of the Middle East and the people of Iraq, because what we did in Iraq destabilized the whole region. And I get into the politics in the book because I became very convicted. You know, people would say to me, especially if I spoke in churches about the persecution and the situation for the Christians there, they would say, yeah, but I just don't do politics. Well, you have to do politics, because politics affect the lives of people. And that the fact that I really believe a lot of this rests with the American church, the situation that Christians are facing there now, because we in the American church said, we don't do politics. We're above that. And yet the Iraqi Christians and the Syrian Christians were living the results of the political decisions that were being made in Washington. I mean, you ask a really hard question. And I don't, it's not just my opinion. A lot of respected foreign policy experts, journalists like Jeffrey Goldberg, who's one of the first journalists to cover Iraq, and Christopher Hitchens would be another one, the late Christopher Hitchens, the first to go in, cover the situation and know it intimately, all coming back years later, said, no, it wasn't. You know, they still would say it wasn't a bad decision. It just was handled so poorly. And there were bad decisions that were made along the way. We stayed too long, perhaps. We set up unrealistic goals that we were not prepared to carry out. We pushed too hard for elections. We insisted on 4 or 5 elections within the first few years while we weren't really, and we made those our benchmarks while we weren't really tending to what the situation was on the ground. And so you came to this point. I mean, one of the sort of moments that is very defining to me of this breakdown, the American breakdown in Iraq, is in 2006 is when I noticed that things were getting significantly worse. And the man who starts the book, Odisha Yusuf, he was kidnapped that year. Another, Father Douglas Bazzi in Baghdad, he was kidnapped and tortured by Islamic militants that year. The church was beginning to see really serious persecution because these Islamic militants were beginning to have their way with the minorities in Iraq. All these things were going on. In the United States, we were having a debate about a surge, a debate about sending more troops back. When the Bush administration persuaded Congress to support that, and we did that, we quickly saw a turnaround, saw some successes, and the military could quantify those successes. But that ended up being the worst year for Iraqi civilians. There were 17,000 Iraqis killed between 2006 and 2007 in that 12-month period. So what was looking like a success here in the United States, looking like something that we could maybe pull out of the ditch, was actually devastating to the Iraqis, and we weren't paying attention to that. And I think that is a pattern that has persisted all the way through. I think it's continuing now under the Obama administration. It's why we can't ever really get out of there, because we just don't ever really fulfill our obligations or fulfill our stated goals when we've gone in there.
Yeah, a couple moments that seem to have stood out, speaking again about the politics of the situation from your account, would have been the process to disband the Ba'ath Party from the very beginning. I think that's pretty commonly acknowledged at this point as a mistake. You don't paint a pretty picture of Paul Bremer and the provisional authority, though I don't think many others do either. So that's not
good. I was trying not to paint a pretty picture.
I figured as much, but the coalition provisional authority does not come through very well in any accounts of the time.
But can I interject right there
on
that point?
Go ahead.
It's a really important point to bring us right up to 2016 and this, that there is one person who is still at large from that infamous deck of cards, Ibrahim al-Douri, and I write about him in the early part of the book, and he comes up at the end. And in Iraq, it's widely acknowledged that he is one of the architects of ISIS. And this is something that we aren't hearing about, this whole thing of disbanding the Ba'ath Party, disbanding the military, and not ever really accounting for that, not ever really taking that vast military and industrial machine that Saddam Hussein had built and training it for better purposes. I think there was a window where we could have done that. And what's happened is now you have al-Douri playing a prominent role with ISIS, coming back around again to try to lead this Sunni onslaught against Iraq. And you have, we just had this week, the United States says that it has arrested the person who they say is in charge of the development of chemical weapons for ISIS.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. We've been hearing for the last 10 years that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction. And now how is it that one of Saddam Hussein's leading top officials in charge of his WMD program in the pre-war years turned out to be leading the development of chemical weapons for ISIS, and we captured him? But what have we been doing all this time? We've been telling ourselves lies. And it's too inconvenient both for the Bush administration and the Obama administration to acknowledge that delegitimizing these Ba'ath Party officials led them into the arms of terrorists. And that's an oversimplification of it, but that's why we're where we still are. And we aren't acknowledging that is why, because for the Obama administration, and for the Democrats, it would mean acknowledging that, yes, there was a huge industrial base that was capable of creating weapons of mass destruction. For the Republicans, it would mean acknowledging, yes, we made a mistake when we didn't deal with the Ba'ath Party. We just kind of tore up their papers and said, go away. We made a mistake when we did that. No one's ready to acknowledge those two things. So we just don't talk about what's actually happening with ISIS.
Well, I think all this, Mindy, is so helpful. Just to give a little bit, you're going a little bit more in depth than you do in the book on some of these issues, which I appreciate. That's what the interview is for. But you do touch on a lot of these issues, and you start to see them through your eyes as a journalist who's on the ground, who's venturing beyond the green zone, putting yourself at significant risk to be able to find out what the actual situation is like. And that's just not a perspective that we get from our media, even if we're paying attention to that. And so that's just one of the many reasons why I just commend They Say We Are Infidels as an amazing book. There's just not that many people who have the contacts, have the sources, have the knowledge, have the history, have the depth to be able to understand and to narrate what's going on there, and a recognition that you simply cannot avoid politics. That it's we have to dig in, we have to understand, we have to bear responsibility, and it's only there that I think then we can pivot back toward understanding our obligation toward our Christian brothers and sisters. Okay, I got a few things that I wanted to work through with you. One is just sort of a quick one. You talk a lot about just so many harrowing accounts from They Say We Are Infidels. The story of the... I didn't know, Mindy, about the story of the American teacher who was killed by one of his students over there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I had completely missed that story there. But so many of the kidnappings, I heard about them, but understanding the actual circumstances was so brutal. But just a... A quick question here. Is there any way to break the kidnapping cycle? I mean, it's just so vicious. You talk to people who are the ones paying the ransom, and then one of the guys paying the ransom, of course, then himself gets kidnapped. There, you know, who comes to get the guy who has the money to pay the ransom to the kidnappers?
Right.
Is there any way to break that cycle?
Right. Well, I think that, you know, part of the answer to that is a lot of what we've been talking about, that the macro matters, the political environment matters, and the lack of security is a really big issue there. And so, you know, if you and I put ourselves in that position, I mean, there is a lot of debate within these Christian communities about whether or not to pay ransom. But if your son is kidnapped, if your husband is kidnapped, and your extended family is going to rally and do everything they can. And you know, this is how the book begins, this incredible network of Iraqis all over the world who actually have stepped in to support and to pay for some of these ransom, the incredible negotiations to get them down to anything approaching a reasonable amount. And then, yes, the money is paid because your obligation to your loved one and love for your loved one demands it in the face of none of these other structures being in place to protect and support you. We saw this just recently. You know, there were the 250 or so Christians kidnapped in Syria from these Christian villages along the Khabar River, and they were held, and these high-level negotiations were going on among Assyrian leaders and Islamic State, and there were, and I was hearing from a number of other Assyrian leaders who were completely dismayed and disappointed that their fellow church members were negotiating with Islamic State. But the result was that these people were released, and so they have their lives and their and those villages have been freed, and some of them are in fact going back to those villages. So because they were successfully freed by the Kurds. They have restored security along that area. It's right there at the Syria-Turkey border. Whether or not it's going to be stabilized enough for them to actually move back in, but a number of those families have gone back. It's one of the only places where that has happened. And that's the result of those negotiations. So it's just you're in a situation where you've moved beyond plan A, plan B, and plan C. And so you're having to come up with plan B and plan E.
I think so. I mean, solutions. So that's so helpful, Mindy, to be able to put that in the context of saying, well, nobody wants to do this in principle, but the situation overall is so terrible that you really can't do anything about it. And if you want your loved one back, you pretty much have to do it. And everybody knows the whole America swaggering, we don't negotiate with terrorists, but that's simply not true. That's not true in actual practice. That may be the public face, but we know there's been all sorts of negotiation regarding the Americans that had held by Islamic State in Syria in particular. And you already alluded to that. And it's, in large sense, been botched for the most part. Rescue operations, things like that, efforts to secure ransom have just been devastating failures in many cases. So it's just part of that ongoing problem.
Well, there are some successes, and they have happened. I mean, I'm more aware of them for Europeans who've been kidnapped in Syria.
That's a good point.
And
right.
We're not under that binding. You know, I think and there have been some Americans whose families were successfully able to negotiate. You don't hear about them, and I haven't written about them because their lives could still be in jeopardy. But they have happened, but they have to happen apart from this kind of blanket, we don't negotiate with terrorists. And I'm not sure that, you know, having as a policy statement, we don't negotiate with terrorists makes a lot of sense. To me, the problem is if you aren't being smart and savvy underneath that to do what you need to do to protect your own citizens. So,
and you end up with confusing. I mean, you just end up in this situation like, I don't really understand how this standard is applied across there. Not to open up yet another can of worms, but just from somebody who's just trying to follow these things in the news, it's not apparent what actual policy is. So I want to bring back to going back again and again to the really the best part of the book is getting to know through your friendship these amazingly inspiring, courageous Christian believers in Iraq. And I'm wondering, help us work through in this last little bit of how do they understand what's happening in terms of their theological perspective about God's purposes? And maybe related to that, where do we find hope in this situation, and how can we help?
Yeah, you know, I have felt the anger and the despair myself, and I always find that going back to the Ansaf Safus and the Anton Autos and the people who people this book are where I find my hope. And, you know, there's the saying of the, not sure which one, but one of the Puritan writers said, God works contrary to means. And I think that might have been Cotton Mather, but I'm not sure. But, you know, that's kind of where you come back around, is that the people who have been most affected by this long war that we've been talking about are the people that you simply cannot keep down. And I come to that place at the end of the book of just recounting how over and over and over, and I go back, I have gone back year after year to see these people, to see how they're doing, and I find that their spirits, they always encourage me. Their spirits are still hopeful, not despairing. They're hardworking. They're not giving up. And the reason is not because the situation has gotten better, or not because they've found Americans they can work with, or they've found a money pipeline that's helping them. The reason is because they have put their faith in Jesus and are fully trusting him. And I think that's why this 2003 trip for me, that I thought was going to be a one-time thing to cover the short war, has turned into more than a decade now of going back and going back and going back, because I keep trying to understand this great anomaly, that there is so much hope and so much of a lack of despair in what is to me a very despairing and distressing
situation. I mean, do they talk about theology? I mean, did they talk with you about processing? How do we understand God's purposes in all of this?
Yeah, I think there is always a level of processing, but I think what I see in Eastern Christianity, I'll say it that broadly, that, you know, is perhaps missing and something we can learn from in Western Christianity, is tremendous reliance on community and on the power of the church being together. And so you have these churches where, I mean, I stayed in a church for a week in Baghdad in 2014, and ISIS was 60 miles out in Fallujah and Ramadi. There were bombings every day in the city. It was a lot less secure than I anticipated, and I had trouble getting around, and it was not easy or pleasant to get around, and yet the churches were meeting every night. They were holding Bible studies. They were holding prayer services. And a few months after I was there, I emailed one of the men in the church, Dalet, who figures prominently at the end of the book. And I asked him how I was doing. And he said, yeah, there's a bomb here. And shopkeeper I know was killed there. And he said, but the church is doing fine. And we've started another prayer group. We have one prayer group that is praying for ourselves and our Christian brothers and sisters. And then we start another prayer group, and that group is to pray for our enemies.
Wow.
And that's something that we just don't do here. I mean, I'm not in a church circle where we would do that, and we would set aside time and we would show up every week and we would do that. And there's a tremendous appreciation, you know, coming for people in this culture, that we can help each other, and if we're daily, weekly doing this together, there's real strength in that.
Your book is a great help in terms of awareness about the situation, and I think everybody listening to this interview can understand the depth of your knowledge and the sincerity of your sympathy and regard for these believers. Certainly it drives us toward prayer. What else? Is there anything else that we can do to help?
Well, we have set up at World Magazine, this is the only way we've really known how to do this. We've set up a page where we list groups whose work we've actually seen in Iraq and in Syria, groups that we know are legitimately getting aid into those parts of the world. So certainly helping that way is one way that people can respond. I have run into, and I do talk about this some in the book, a number of creative efforts by Americans and others helping. There's a church in Indiana that ended up helping to pay rent for some of the displaced Christians that are now living in northern Iraq. I think that's something that can be replicated. That church was very brave. They sent a team of about 10 men over to Iraq. None of them had ever, I interviewed a number of them, none of them had ever been to Iraq before, just within weeks of the ISIS invasion, because they so wanted to do something. And so they sent them over, you know, kind of as scouts and spies to see what the situation was. And out of that has grown a tremendous relationship with one of the existing churches in Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. And they're helping through that church, but they've established an open relationship of trust and communication there. I think that more churches in the United States could do that. And certainly the Iraqis would welcome it. I hope that people reading this book will be encouraged to think about how what we can learn from the examples that are in the book that we can apply in our own churches, that we can apply certainly as we think about refugees coming to this country and what kind of welcome, what kind of community will they enter into, how will they interact with the rest of us who've been here for longer. I think there's a lot to apply that way. And so those are things I think that are practical and that I hope people will spurred to think in those ways after reading the book. Right at the top of our homepage, it's called Aid for Iraqis.
Well, that's, again, good place to start. And good to have tangible examples of that we can follow. The situation can be so overwhelming, especially when you imagine the entire geopolitical situation, that the examples of the Iraqis themselves that you talk about is to show that small gestures made in faith can have a huge effect and mean mm-hmm. a great deal to those people who are suffering and trying to get through each day. Just to wrap up here, I want to remind people, encourage you to start with that awareness component. The book, again, is They Say We Are Infidels on the Run from ISIS with Persecuted Christians in the Middle East. Mindy Bells has been my guest. She's the author of the book and senior editor of World Magazine. In addition to those of you who have already planned or we hope will join us in Indianapolis for the Gospel Coalition's 2016 Women's Conference in June, Mindy will be on a panel on the persecuted church with others, including Nancy Guthrie and Don Carson. And she'll also be giving a workshop specifically related to issues that are covered in this book of ISIS, hearing some of these stories. And she's also going to be doing a focus gathering whose registrations will be open on the Friday evening of the conference, where she's going to be helping people to think through current events. A couple of those opportunities at least are open to those of you who are not yet registered for the conference, and would encourage you to join us June 16 to 18 in Indianapolis. Just go to tgc.org/2016. Mindy, thank you very much for this work, something unlike anything that I've read before, and certainly a major challenge, thought-provoking, and a challenge to my faith, and really a motivation to want to do something about it. So thank you, Mindy.
Colin, thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org.